Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
The Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York is where some of the most famous names in baseball, heck, some of the most famous names in American culture, are honored. Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Ty Cobb, Ted Williams. More recently, guys like Tom Seaver, Hank Aaron, Ken Griffey Jr. But, you know, there are also names in the Hall of Fame whom many don't recall at all. Guys like Jake Beckley and Dan Brothers, Chick Haffey, Bid McPhee, Ross Youngs, several others. On this episode of Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to look back at the career of one of the most obscure inductees into the Hall. A guy who played the game for 16 years, hit .279, and was on two teams that won the World Series. His magic with the glove, however, is what set him apart. He's a beauty of a story. Dave Bancroft.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 122, Dave Bancroft. One of the most obscure members of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Bancroft started his career in 1915 with the Philadelphia Phillies and finished it with the New York Giants in 1930. In between, he also played for the Boston Braves and the Brooklyn Dodgers. Oh, while he ended his career with the Giants in 1930, his first stint with the team from 1920 through 1923 were some of the best seasons of his career, a span that included three trips to the Fall Classic and twice the Giants won it all. Joining me on today's podcast is author Tom Alicia, who recently released a book about Dave Bancroft called Beauty at Short. Now, if you're looking for a really easy read, and if you like baseball history, this certainly fits the bill. Tom delves into a lot, but his writing is smooth and it flows so well. Seriously, pick up a copy. You will enjoy it. Before we get into today's show, just a few reminders and notes. Follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter at SportsFHeroes. Look for our page on Facebook, and don't forget to visit Sports Forgotten Heroes online at sportsfh.com. Also, Sports Forgotten Heroes is a proud member of the Sports History Network. Check out the site online, sportshistorynetwork.com. There are a lot of great shows about the history of the games we love. And if you're a fan, check out the shop. You can even get a pretty cool-looking Sports Forgotten Heroes coffee mug. That's sportshistorynetwork.com. Okay, let's get into today's show about the great Dave Bancroft with my guest, Tom Alicia. Tom, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. Thrilled to have you aboard.
It's nice to be here, Warren.
When did you first learn of Dave Bancroft, and what interested you so much that you decided to put pen to paper?
There's 10 years ago, my wife and son and I were on vacation in northern Wisconsin. And northern Wisconsin, especially along the Lake Superior border, is a very isolated place. And the closest city was Superior, Wisconsin. We went into there and we took a look at the internet and to see what's in this town and of note. And one line was underneath most of the other things, and that was Baseball Hall of Famer Dave Bancroft is buried here. And all three of us are big baseball fans, and it was just that piqued my curiosity right away. And I said, "Can we let's go stop by there?" And we did. We couldn't find the gravesite. We eventually did. It was an in-ground, very anonymous stone, and right off a gravel road. His wife was next to it. No mention of baseball, just husband, date, or birth, death, his name, that's it, nothing. And that began my curiosity 10 years ago. I'd always thought it'd be an article because of, microfilm is just so monotonous to get details. Well, then suddenly I had a lot from microfilm. And then 4 years ago, I realized that if I combine three newspaper websites in terms of that cover about 85% of the papers in the country, and literally started from 1891, his date of birth, straight through to a couple years after his death, which was in 1972. And I thought there were so many nights that I would stay up late, and the next morning I would tell my wife a new Bancroft story. And that's when I knew. I thought, I've got a book here.
It's so funny that you say that Bancroft's tombstone or headstone was just so plain and not a lot to it, because I don't think that you are that far off by saying that Dave Bancroft is one of baseball's, if not baseball's, least known Hall of Famer. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at his stats on paper, they're not that impressive. 279 career hitter with 32 home runs, 591 runs batted in. Not overly impressive. Yes. He played from 1915 to 1930. So what made him a Hall of Fame player? And of course, we're going to discuss so much about it, Dave, on the podcast. But in short, what made him a Hall of Fame player?
His glove. And there is, to a degree, without the flips, obviously, there is a legitimate comparison to Ozzie Smith.
I was just going to go there. I was just thinking to myself, if you're just talking about glove, I don't know if Ozzie gets in on offense alone. He's definitely getting in on his glove.
And that's very much Bancroft's story. In fact, one of the greatest things that's happened about this book, and so many wonderful things have happened since it came out 5 months ago. But 2 days ago, I got a text from a friend, and that person was in St. Louis and passed along a copy of the book to Ozzie Smith. And I thought, that's
cool.
The greatest.
That's
cool. It doesn't get much cooler than that. I thought that's really neat. That similarity is really significant. And those numbers, you read them off. And, when you said the home run totals, I had to take a look and I thought, was it really that low? And I thought, yeah, okay, he's right. 32, But the 279, I mean, we do have to keep in mind that six of those seasons were during the dead ball era.
Mm-hmm,
Eliminate those, suddenly that batting average jumps to
Yeah, he had years where he hit 318, 321, 304, 319, 311. So it's not like he was an awful ball player. By heck, he's a Hall of Famer. But
yeah.
It was a 279 career batting average, and you're right. He crossed the bridge from the dead ball era to the live ball era.
Yeah, and the you got to look, too, I think, at some of the teams that he was on, and the fact that he played in four World Series as a rookie in 1915. He was a significant part, played every game, I believe. If he might have missed one, his rookie season with the Philadelphia Phillies, and helped them get to the World Series. Now, granted, okay, that team had Grover Cleveland-Alexander as a pitcher and a workhorse, too. So that helps. That helps. But, you know, Grover's shortstop that whole season was a rookie named Dave Bancroft, who spent 6 years, barely got into the major leagues. And that's part of the unlikely part, is the story beforehand, too. But keep in mind, you know, so two World Series that he was a significant part of, or four World Series that he played in, but two of them that he won with the Giants and played extremely well, beating the Yankees 1921 and 1922. So there were always moments in there that were significant. And I guess I'm kind of defensive sometimes. Enough of this. I've done such a deep dive into his career and enjoyed it so much that it saddens me that it is his story was so forgotten. But it's one of the wonderful things now, too, that with the last 5 months since the book has come out, he's had two hometowns. He grew up in Sioux City, Iowa. And he lived most of his life as an adult in Superior, Wisconsin, a very isolated spot. Hockey players, football players, Olympic curlers. That's where, you know, it's a cold place, Superior, Wisconsin. And that's where he lived from, geez, age 20 until his death at age 82. So he was isolated. But, you know, there is a sense that those towns now, thanks to the book, thanks to some of the people who live in those places, we've got a plaque now at the minor league park in Sioux City, Iowa, dedicated to Dave Bancroft. And it's wonderful that that's happening. And it's also stunning how few people in those cities, the cities that you would hope that really would know beforehand about him, don't. Or weren't aware, or vaguely aware that, oh, yeah, there was a Hall of Famer who was born here. But not like you would so many others. And then you see so many other honors for how towns respond to players who, you know, either grew up in their city or lived in their city for a long time. Quite a few are honored. There's nothing in Superior, Wisconsin. And we're working right now to change that. Literally with the city of Superior. So, and it's looking very good. Like something will happen, that something will be named after him or a plaque will go up.
Oh, that's cool. Well, let's go back. His road to the major leagues was not easy. He made his debut at the age of 24. But to get there, he certainly bounced around a lot. And
yes,
he nearly quit a few times, too. So tell us about his time in the minors and trying to break through. And by the way, he played in the PCL, the Pacific Coast League, as well. And
yes,
that was almost like a second major league back then. I mean, teams, they were not affiliated with Major League Baseball teams. So baseball was quite different back in the early 1900s. Talk about Dave's journey to Philadelphia and the minor leagues.
And it was bumpy. Before the PCL, where he played with Portland, the Portland Beavers, he was right out of, or before he even finished high school, because there's no record of him even playing his senior year of high school at Sioux City High School. There is during his sophomore and junior year. We have pictures and names, but not during his senior year. That's because in all likelihood, he had already left to join, and I love this name more than anything, the Waterloo, Iowa Lulus. The Lulus. Low-level minor league team wanted him. He started out fine there, but the manager was furious at one error that he had made. And then the next one, a ground ball deep, he wasn't sure whether to try to force the guy out at second, throw it to first, and he hung on to the ball. Manager was so upset. This is 1909. He was so furious that he cut Bancroft. Bancroft went up to north to Duluth, Minnesota, 500 miles north in 1909. He gets a tryout. And of course, in those days, tryouts were, hey, we'll put you in a game. Here's a uniform. You know, you're a member of the team. Let's see what you can do. And he played a few series with them, and he did fine. He had one particularly very good game, but they cut him. They had enough players. They were set. They were an experienced team. And fortunately, the story doesn't end there, because the manager of the Superior minor league team happened to have seen a game. His team had started out 2-13. He saw a game, and in all likelihood, it probably was that game that Bancroft played really well. He took Bancroft right away. He needed players for his team, good players, especially a good fielder. And Bancroft, always throughout his career, you always know that he's fielding well. He joined Superior. He's 3 years at the lowest level of minor league baseball for 3 years, 1909, 1910, 1911. And when I say lowest level, that's a lot of stuff. And you're talking more than 300 teams.
Wow.
In the minor leagues. Yeah. Wow. So, and not a lot of major league teams in the National League or American League. Three seasons there. And fortunately, he gets a shot in the PCL with the Portland Beavers after three seasons. He gets there, and what's the problem? His hitting, he's not hitting well, to the point where he packed his bags and walked to the train station, and he was happened to run into one of his teammates and said, where are you going? He said, I'm going home. I can't hit. And it was one of the veteran players on the team, Bill Raw Meat Rogers. I just love that nickname. And he turned him around and he said, "Don't come back." You know, he recognized certainly the fielding, but then at the same time, he also recognized that this was a young guy.
Right. This was the main situation with Dave. All glove, no hit. And he was just so darn discouraged that Rogers and I think a guy by the name of Art Krueger,
yes,
you know, took Dave under their wing and helped him become a better hitter. Because, again, that was the crux of the situation with Dave. He had a terrific glove, but he struggled at the plate.
Yeah, and with them, they made one key suggestion among many suggestions, but the one that did change it was they told him be a turnaround hitter. At that time, that's what a switch hitter was called. Let's try it. And he immersed himself in that and was a switch hitter then his entire career after that. He also, you know, they gave him suggestions of other things, which is, you know, everything from a lot of practice to, you know, lay off certain pitches, things like that. Interestingly, one of the two then goes on to Krueger becomes minor league coach for a very long time after that. It's interesting to see the backgrounds of these two guys, the ones who did then give him a little push. But, you know, here's what happens then in Portland. In Portland, he's in the PCL. he sticks around then for that whole season. And what happens the next season? Portland adds a second team, minor league team, and called the Portland Colts, and they join the Northwestern League, and that's much lower than the PCL. And the second season in Portland, that's where they put Dave Bancroft. And he starts to hit better. His glove is always there yet again. And the next season, his sixth in the minor leagues, which is starting to get up there in numbers, you know, when you're in 6 years in the minor leagues at that time. And he had a very, very good season in 1914 with the Portland Beavers in the PCL. That alone should be get you in to the major leagues. But there were a lot of hesitant teams, and the Phillies had sent somebody to go west and sign someone else to become their shortstop. And what happened was that player was starting to make overtures that he might go to the Federal League, the new league that was starting up.
Sure.
And that was enough to scare off the Phillies scout who was signing, wanted to make sure that someone was there. He signs Bancroft. Bancroft then shows up in spring training with the Phillies. Pat Moran, the manager, says he looks more like a jockey than he does a baseball player.
But after small guy. He wasn't exactly a big guy. I mean, he was 5'9" and 160,
yeah.
Sopping wet.
But that's not an uncommon size, actually, for players at that time. He certainly wasn't small. I mean, one of the remarkable things, whenever you see a photo of, especially the New York Giants of that time, often the infield lined up, Frankie Frisch, Heinie Groh, and High Pockets Kelly. Well, High Pockets Kelly was 6'4", and he just absolutely towers over all three of these guys in photos that you see. So the size wasn't, you know, was he that short? 5'9". One of the things with touring with the book is I made sure, I thought, what's the one thing that I could get that would get some attention? And that was for exhibits, and we've had two of them in museums in his hometowns. And that was life-size cutouts of them. And the life-size cutouts are 6 feet.
Interesting.
They're 6 feet. So I made him about 3 inches taller than he actually was. His life-size cutout is actually too big. So, he looks pretty good in the life-size cutout. But the real thing was, strike zone was a little smaller, I think. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, before we go on, it was in the minors where he earned his nickname, Beauty. Tell us about that.
You know, there is quite a bit of debate as to whether it started there or not. The first time it's ever mentioned, and just like you brought up earlier, how that PCL was really considered like a second big leagues. It really was on that West
uh-huh.
Coast.
Yeah.
And there are newspapers in Portland, Los Angeles Times. I mean, the whole West Coast covered their teams extremely close. There's never a mention over 3 years of the nickname Beauty. Over 5.5 seasons with the Philadelphia Phillies, there is never a mention of the nickname Beauty. The first time it pops up is when he joins the New York Giants, and the New York papers pick up on the fact that he says the word Beauty when there's a good play in the field or he's at bat and there's a pretty good pitch, that might just blow by him. And he says, Beauty. He says that and they pick up on him, and that's what it is. The odd thing is that the Hall of Fame biography of him does a big pull quote on the page, and it talks about that this started in Portland, and I can't find anything that he was doing that. And maybe he was saying that, but he certainly wasn't nicknamed Beauty until the New York sports media, and at that time, just massive influence that they had. Excuse me. And they started calling him Beauty in 1921. So it's really started a little later. And then it really picked up even after his career. And I think even to contemporary times, because it's such a fun nickname, that it stuck with him throughout.
So he bounces around the minors up and down and up and down. And
yep.
Finally signs on with the Philadelphia Phillies in 1915. And he actually had a decent rookie season. Mm-hmm. 254, seven dingers, and those seven home runs were the most he ever hit in one season. Had 30 ribbies, 18 doubles, two triples. He had 15 steals. He led the majors being caught 27 times. But it was mainly his glove that kept him in the lineup. Tell us about his rookie season and how that set him up for such a successful 16-year career.
Yeah, immediately, you know, when Pat Moran was the manager of the Phillies at that time, when I say talks to, you know, describe him first, he looks like a jockey instead of a baseball player. You know, at the same time, he also recognized what Bancroft can do in the infield. And Bancroft called him later his first real manager, his first real coach, somebody who worked with him extremely closely and even more at a higher level in terms of batting and fielding, moving around. He was one of the first shortstops to start to move around depending on who the batter was. And then his rookie season, what was so important is the team won. And I mean, let's put this in perspective in terms of Philadelphia, by Philadelphia standards. The Phillies ended up winning the NL pennant that season. And that is a shock because there was a wonderful headline beforehand, and that is gloom awaits Quaker City in 1915 season. And that was before the season started, okay? So that's preseason. They win the NL pennant. They go to the World Series. In the game that they win, Bancroft plays a key role. He hits .294 in the five games. They lose four games to one to the Boston Red Sox and another World Series debut. It was Babe Ruth's World Series debut,
too. It was his first World Series.
One at bat. He was, of course, a pitcher for those first few years of his career, but he didn't pitch in that World Series, but he did one at bat and made a ground out. But Bancroft came through in the one win that there was. Now, what's significant about that? Well, let's talk about Philadelphia history. And that is that Philadelphia then does not win another World Series game. They lost 4-0 in the 1950 World Series. They don't win another World Series game until 1980.
Wow.
And yeah, isn't that amazing how many years? And the irony too is that despite the fact that he did play a significant role on several very good Philadelphia teams, including one that went to the World Series, is he's in the Hall of Fame, but he's not on the Phillies Wall of Fame. So you still have, you know, probably the only guy in Cooperstown who's not in a team that he played for 5.5 years, Wall of Fame. Something we try to once again influence or try to hope that they will pay attention to, hey, wave our flag for Bancroft to be included. But Philadelphia fans aren't as welcoming, I think.
They probably don't even know the name.
they've started to, but they, you know, they're skewing now towards, you know, contemporary players and definitely looking at that 1980 team that won the World Series. And you're seeing a lot of those players get in the Phillies Hall of Fame.
You know, so the Phillies lose that series, a 1915 series. Obviously, they had a great season. And in your book, Beauty at Short, you mention a couple of other unique things about that World Series. You know, Bancroft hit 294, Babe Ruth's. It was his first World Series. Woodrow Wilson was the president at that time, and he became the first president to throw out the first pitch.
Yes.
But what I find most interesting is the Phillies and the Red Sox both opted to play in stadiums that were not their home stadiums.
Yes.
Why? I mean, that's weird. I mean, the Phillies play all year at Shide Park, then they play the World Series at the Baker Bowl. The Red Sox play their year at Fenway. At the World Series, they opt to play at Braves Field. What's going on here?
Well, the first, the Red Sox did change. The Phillies did play at Baker Bowl. The World Series was played at Baker Bowl, where the Phillies played their home game.
Oh,
they
okay.
didn't. They opted against it. And in the end, who knows
whether they had the opportunity. They had the opportunity to play at Shot.
And they chose against
it.
And of course, you know, I mean, at that time, and this was significant. I mean, can you imagine at that time that bonus for winning a World Series probably was as much as your salary, you know, at that time for a player. So this is significant money. Can you imagine today if, you know, and then the loser's share was probably, oh, 60, 70% of what you were making during the year. So, and that share, of course, was determined by one thing, and that is how many fans came and how much money was gate receipts were totaled. And then that was portioned out and divvied up to the players, to the winning team, and then to the losing players. And Bancroft, you know, that money was really important, especially to a young player. That's why the Braves or the Red Sox chose not to play in their home field. They went to the Braves field, which is just could fit more fans in it. And obviously increase the share for each player.
So
amazing at that time,
it's interesting.
And they chose, the point is why they chose not to play in Fenway Parks.
That's crazy. You know? Yeah, it's just crazy.
This brand new, well, relatively, you know, be 3 years old at that time, you know, the sparkling Fenway Park.
Yeah. So as we talk, as we've discussed, Dave Bancroft had a marvelous glove. Talk about the kind of impression that he made on everyone with his slick fielding. I mean, here he is. He's just like, you know, 2 years into his major league career, and he's being compared to some of the game's greats at that time. And he was doing things no one had ever seen.
You know, one of the people he's most mentioned with is Hannes Wagner. Hannes Wagner, we get that, you know, that the baseball card that's worth, you know,
I think it was just sold again for like $12 million.
You know, it's just astonishing. But and the remarkable thing is this, you know, I mean, obviously today, if you mention that name, Hannes Wagner, immediately you think of just the baseball card. But at that time, that was the player. You know, when you were starting to be compared with him, that's some good company. You know, you were definitely getting some respect that way. And Bancroft just continued that, and his hitting started to improve. Not, you know, I mean, each of the years with the Phillies, they lost, as soon as they lost Grover Cleveland Alexander, and he was traded, you know, for the owner took him because he needed, you know, was more interested in cash than making sure that he had a good team on the field. So Grover Cleveland Alexander left after the first three seasons that Bancroft was there. And the Phillies were fantastic. They were second place in the second and third years at Bancroft.
Yeah, I mean, the Phillies were good, and a lot of that had to do with Dave and his glove. But, for instance, like in 1916, they go 91-62 with a tie. Yeah. But he broke his ankle towards the end of the season, and with Dave in the lineup, or with Dave not in the lineup, they just were not as good. How devastating a blow was it to the Phillies that Bancroft couldn't play? And just how much of a difference was he, or how much better was he than his replacements?
You know, and his replacements come in, and you know, he was such a staple at shortstop that, and you see this throughout his career, that when replacements come in, you know, odds are they hadn't had a lot of time at shortstop because he played a lot of innings. So even in that particular situation, yeah, then the Phillies start moving. Okay, we're going to take our third baseman. We'll be at shortstop right now. You know, I mean, there was not somebody who had very much time at shortstop. An injury to him may have cost them a chance at the pennant in that year, and in all likelihood did. Then you look through, and it just really did continue while he was a Philly. You know, it becomes difficult. There's a season 1919 then when you talk about his time with the Phillies. And, you know, obviously you can't escape the cloud of World War One during that time. The season was shortened. You know, obviously priorities were split. You know, there was talk of just stopping base. Should we continue baseball at all? Well, there's a war going on. And a number of players, you know, continued and some stepped forward to join the war effort. Bancroft did not. He was married and he chose not to join in 1919. At the same time, Philadelphia, right at that time too, and towards the end of World War One, you see that Philadelphia is dealing with not only the after effects of the war, but the Spanish flu overwhelms that city in the last year and a half that Bancroft was playing for the Phillies. And when I say overwhelms, I'm saying that they were tens of thousands of people died in that city from a contagious Spanish flu. And the irony of it is that the city and the Phillies were very much supportive of it and participating, had a parade that was trying to support the war effort, but in a sense it worked in horribly in reverse, that it spread a flu just as you know, the COVID virus could spread. Right. Well, a deadly flu continued to spread right there. So there's the end of his time in Philadelphia is not a good one. And he was ready to go, and I think they were ready to deal him.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so
it's wonderful though.
Yeah, what happens is great. So they go to the series in 15, his rookie year. They're really good in 16. They finish in second. Mm-hmm. They're competitive in 17. But 1918, 1919, and 1920, they're pretty much a bad team. The owner of the team, you referred to it before, William Baker, always seemed to be in some sort of financial distress.
Yes.
And he and Dave just didn't get along. So the Phillies shipped Bancroft north to the New York Giants for cash. Can you tell us any more about that? Was there any other underlying reason why the Phillies would get rid of Bancroft?
Oh, no. And in fact, Baker got on a train because he could not believe the amount that the New York Giants were willing to give them. Now, there were a number of other teams, Cincinnati Reds, Pittsburgh, that were interested in Bancroft. Bancroft was hitting well at that time. His batting average is now way up there. You add that glove once again. You have still a young man, you know. He's definitely has a lot of years.
1929, he's only 29 years old. Yeah. And for that season, he had 299.
And but the one man who wanted him the most and stepped forward and paid $100,000 was John McGraw. And it was a wonderful pairing because those two, as gruff as McGraw was, Bancroft was his kind of player. Scrappy, let's just move up one base, you know, relentless, somebody who's going to be in there day in and day out, not going to be a problem for you off the field. They got along superbly. And that really helped, obviously, both of their careers. I think one of the things that's forgotten is McGraw didn't win a World Series for a number of years before Bancroft showed up there. And obviously, he was not a one-person team on the New York Giants. That team was loaded with great players. But, you know, he was part of that cog. He was the captain of the team. He was the leadoff hitter. And they start to win. They start to win a lot. And they go to three straight World Series.
Yeah, you know, around this same time, well, off the field, he's living a pretty good life. He's happily married. And you refer to this in your book. He's happily married. He and his wife, Edna, wanted a family, but it didn't happen. Tell us about how unfortunate they were. And did it have an effect on Dave?
You know, that is that's probably the saddest part of this whole story. And, you know, when you're doing research on a player like this, you're doing it on your free time, and you're doing it, for me, it was very late at night, very late at night. And throughout everything that I had read about Dave and his wife, Edna Bancroft, were that they had been married 60 plus years. It was a very, very close relationship. They got married when she was 18 and he was 19. That's a major reason why he stayed in Superior, Wisconsin his whole life, because that's where her family was at. She was extremely supportive, a great supportive baseball wife for him, knowledgeable about the game too, went to the game, supported him. They are described as childless in every single mention of her, of him, of his family. And that's not true. In that 1920, Edna gave birth to a girl, Mary Jane, and she lived only 16 days. During that 16 days, you can see that several newspapers quoted Dave as being just ecstatically happy about having a daughter, having a child. And then you hear nothing after that. And he was even, for the first time in his career, was not at spring training when it started that season, and comes back, and it just sort of says, it says private reasons or personal business or something to that effect. But certainly the fact that this couple didn't have a child was certainly one of the saddest things to uncover. And then to see what had happened and the fact that it was never discussed. There's no article. And then the sad part too, is that you see through his career then later how much he was loved by, or just loved children. And Edna was too. Yeah. There's absolutely fantastic stories of them babysitting kids of other players, kids of sports writers, it includes their own nieces and nephews. One of my favorite pictures and so many photos from, say, pre-1930 of baseball players are that, you know, that stone-faced look, You know, it's the same photo. I see it over and over and over, and it doesn't matter who the player is. And for Bancroft, there's just a fantastic one where when he's later with the Boston Braves and he's holding up a child who's at the game. It was a boys club event. And he holds up the boy and his face is just, he's just looking up in such admiration at the little boy that he's hoisting up. And that's just fantastic. It's just, you know, and it happened mm-hmm. clearly throughout his life. And one of the wonderful things about the publication of the book too, is that I've heard from people who remember him in the late 1960s and early 1970, 1971. And they said that they remember walking to school and seeing Dave and Edna give them a wave as they would sit on their porch and they would see them as they're going to school and they would just wave at some of the kids. So it's definitely, you know, something that is clearly this was a couple that would have made magnificent parents. And unfortunately, we're not able to be it.
Tom, one of the things I always say to my guests who have written books, of course, is we can't cover everything because if we did, there'd be no reason, we'd be here a while, but there'd be no reason to buy the book. So we do jump around a little. So let's get back to the diamond. Tell us a little bit about Dave's relationship with John McGraw.
Oh, wonderful. And one of the books that gives the best indication of someone who was able to view it on a personal level, and that is Mrs. McGraw. Mrs. McGraw wrote a book, and John McGraw's wife in 1952, she wrote a book about John, and she talks about that. Her husband laughed more with Dave Bancroft than with just about anyone. And that just shows the personal aspect. She also admired Edna, Dave's wife. Bancroft then is really influenced too by McGraw's style.
Yeah, Dave wants to become a manager.
McGraw's style is, you know, is rough, you know. I mean, is old school at the time when old school didn't exist. It was, you know, my way or goodbye.
Right.
And he carried that over then into when he became a player manager with the Boston Braves shortly after several years with the New York Giants.
The Giants had one heck of a team when Dave got there. They were really good. Twice they won the series, as you said earlier, 21 and 22. How important was Dave to their success? And that had to also be a part of the million-dollar infield.
Yes.
Who consisted of the million-dollar infield, and why were they known as the million-dollar infield? And then you got to go back and tell me again how important Dave was to their success.
He was huge, you know, at shortstop. He was also the team captain too. So there was a sense of, you know, that he was McGraw's voice on the field too. He followed that. He settled in really well. I mean, and it helps too to have Frankie Frisch right around you too on that infield. And, you know, I mean, George High Pocket Skelly, the first baseman, you know, became a Hall of Famer. Heinie Groh, they were dubbed the million-dollar infield. And of course, now you look back and, well, you assume that it's literally, but no, they're, of course, their salaries weren't anywhere near, you know. I mean, they right. would have been the $50,000 infield. They're barely the $50,000 infield if you took their salaries at that time.
Some guys make that and won at bat today.
And they, you know, so there's, it's great that that description of those guys is the million-dollar infield being how good they are. and a way to describe them. What's the best way you can describe them? And they come up with, you know, that this is the $1 million infield, something out of, you know, out of reach. So it was magnificent. And, you know, he had a lot of wonderful games with the Giants. And in fact, one of the games with the, whether it was motivated by the fact that he was, I mean, he certainly wasn't upset that he was traded by the Phillies, but it is ironic that, you know, Bancroft as a Giant plays the Phillies and he goes 6 for 6. He gets 6 singles in a game, in a 9-inning game. And at that, of course, a number of people have done that, but in 9 innings, you know, all singles are him. It's vintage Bancroft in terms of his batting. He's not going to get you any long ball, but he's going to peck away and get on base and make things happen. There were other guys on the team, and this was with Philadelphia too, that could drive him in. So there were, you know, those were wonderful years for them. And unfortunately, then the 23 World Series, it became, you know, Ruth just took over. And the Yankees as a whole, really did.
Let's talk about this for a second. So overall, the last year of his career, 1930, he played a couple games with the Giants, mm-hmm. but really when you look at his career with the Giants, it was parts of 5 seasons, we'll call it. He hit .310, stole 48 bases, won 2 World Series, both against the Yankees, before losing in the 1923 World Series to the Yankees. And then he was shipped to Boston to the Braves. Why?
There were it's multiple reasons. Number one, in the 1923 season, part of the season, he's injured. He's replaced by a young shortstop named Travis Jackson, who became a Hall of Famer himself. McGraw had a backup shortstop. He knew that, and he wanted Travis Jackson to play. At the same time, he was never gonna sell Dave Bancroft short. They were too close. And at the same time, he knew that Dave was ready to manage, and Dave really wanted to. And he traded him then to the Boston Braves. And at that time, when you look at all the articles, everybody feels like the Braves got the great part of the deal. And in the end, for the most part, they did. That it was McGraw doing a favor as much for Dave Bancroft. Being a player manager at that time meant a significant pay increase. And also it was an idea or prestige came along with that too. Your star players, you know, Rogers, Hornsby, and a number of other players were player managers. And unfortunately for Dave, the Boston Braves weren't a great team, and his playing was sensational, but to manage and to play was extremely difficult. When you look at it, few people lasted more than a year or two doing that. He did it for 4 seasons with an extremely struggling team. So when you look at why would John McGraw give up, you know, a guy he likes and a guy who was playing very well and helped bring him to a World Series. Well, 2 reasons. I think one was that he knew that Dave wanted a chance at manager, and McGraw was able to make that happen. They remained extremely close. And of course, he comes back in 1930. The other reason being that, you know, there was in the back of McGraw's mind was that he wanted this Travis Jackson to get a chance. And, you know, Travis Jackson delivered for sure when after Bancroft left. So it worked out for both of them. He managing, though, was, you know, it's one of the things that he, when he looked back decades later,
wasn't a whole lot of success.
Regret.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of, not a whole lot of success there. And it's weird because here he's the player manager, but after the 1927 season, he gets shipped to Brooklyn. So here he's a player manager, and now he's no longer the player manager. He finishes his career in Brooklyn, two seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not really finishes his career there because 1930 plays 10 more games for the Giants. When did the thought of the Hall of Fame enter his mind? Did it? Enter the mind of anybody else? Who thought he was worthy of induction? At what point?
Well, you got to then keep in mind that the first group went in about 1936 or so. I mean, it didn't exist.
So
he was on the ballot a number of times from 1938 to 1962. Now this is the writer's ballot, and we all know that anyone who gets in that way, it's a pretty obvious choice. There aren't a lot of questions about players who get in that way as to whether they deserve it. In fact, it's they're almost too difficult to get in. Sometimes that they'll make players wait a couple extra years when really they're their choices that are pretty obvious. Throughout that time that he was on the writer's ballot, of course, there was never a chance he's going to get 75% of the vote. None. he wasn't getting in. The highest he got was 16.5% during that time. Yet, when throughout the 40s, 50s, and 1960s, when people would put together their all players who played at the Polo Grounds team, favorite shortstops, all-time switch hitters, best fielders came up a lot too with him. When Connie Mack looked back on 50 years of Philadelphia baseball, Dave Bancroft is named right on with them, and picked. So his name is always right there in a Hall of Fame discussion, definitely not at the writer's level. And then fortunately, they add the Veterans Committee then in 1960s. And that is where many, many players of a real high caliber get into Cooperstown. And that's what the job of that group was, to find those players that the writers missed or were maybe set their standards way too high, but yet still were deserving players. You do see him mentioned. Pye Trainer in 1964 says, Bancroft should be in the Hall of Fame. So there were hints of it. Dave Bancroft did go to the Hall of Fame in 1965. But he paid his way in. So he just went to the he went to the Hall of Fame to as a like you and me. you pay your admission, you walk around. No, he didn't make a big fuss of it at all. But that's true. He was 75 years old. He knew that there was a Veterans Committee, he knew there was a chance, and certainly when Frankie Frisch joined, he knew that maybe he'd be part of discussions. Mm-hmm. But the years rolled on, and that includes with Frankie Frisch there, 69, 70, 1968, I believe Frankie Frisch started on that committee. Nothing. He wasn't getting in. And he's 80 years old. He's not in great health. And actually very poor health. He didn't think it was going to happen. He thought his time had, that his chances had come and gone in those last years. And boy, he was wrong.
Yeah, how surprising was it in 1971 when the Veterans Committee voted him in, and gave him a phone call saying, hey, guess what, Dave? You're a Hall of Famer.
He was stunned. He was stunned. And what happens is, and it's one of the biggest myths that I hope the book dispels, he is lumped with the Frisch's pals, you know, the teammates of Frankie Frisch, most of them St. Louis Cardinals as opposed to New York Giants, who Frisch got in through the Veterans Committee. But if you really look at it closely, 1971 was the perfect storm of 12 people who met in New York on January 31st, 1971. And two people were added or new to the committee, replacing two other people. And the two people who were added were Wade Hoyt, who pitched against Bancroft and all of those World Series as a New York Yankee, and Bill Terry, who was a star on the team when Bancroft was an assistant coach with the New York Giants. That helped. Already in that then were three other players who played with him at that time, four sports writers, two of whom were very close friends to Bancroft from way back until even the time that he was an elderly man. They maintained friendships. You had then some executives, and then you have Frankie Frisch. Did Frankie Frisch go in there and stomp his fist and say, Dave Bancroft is in? Definitely not. If he would have, Dave Bancroft would have gotten in the Hall of Fame 1, 2, 3 years sooner than he did in 1971. No, in fact, that's the myth really is that Frisch engineered this. When you look at the number or the people who were in there, who were talking, sitting around a table, discussing who gets in, who doesn't, you separate Dave Bancroft from the group of the Frisch people, because there were too many other people who are on the record as being such huge fans of Dave Bancroft that were on that committee and afterwards spoke very highly of him too. So you know that they were yes votes right from the beginning of the conversation. Now, the fact that seven people got in that year makes a lot of people roll their eyes. Did he get in because he didn't deserve it, you know, or, oh no, it's just so he's lumped in with the Frisch group. But when you look at those people that everybody rolls their eyes at, and you take a really close look at everything in their careers, Bancroft deserves to be there. There's mm-hmm. no doubt.
Mm-hmm. All right, couple last things before we wrap up today's episode. You said that when he looks back at his career, he sort of regrets managing Boston, but he did want to be a manager. And after his career ended, he bounced around a little, managing Minneapolis, Sioux City, St. Cloud, but he also managed in the All-America Girls Professional Baseball League, and he managed for four seasons.
Yes.
So what did you find out about that? How did he enjoy that experience?
He loved it. He really did. Not the last season, because he was eventually with a team, the Battle Creek Bells, and there was a lot of financial trouble and they were losing. That was a difficult season, but just eliminate from your mind the Tom Hanks character in A League of Their Own. This was Dave Bancroft was not a boozy, you know, someone who kind of half looked at the players and, you know, didn't care about the games. He took it real seriously. Mm-hmm. And he also is part of one of the things in women's baseball history that isn't mentioned is he was the manager of a team that of women's all-stars from that league in winter, January to March of 1949, that toured and played 50 plus games in Central and South America.
Wow.
I mean, that is remarkable at that time that they were playing then Cuban women and, or they would play, they would take the American teams and split them into to two teams and play an exhibition there and in all sorts of countries. Dave Bancroft, manager, played in more than 20 countries, which is just astounding at that time to think of it. He was loved in South Bend, where he was a coach for 2 years in the women's league. There's a wonderful picture of Dave Bancroft night at the South Bend Blue Sox game. And there's four of the players, you know, each puckering up to a man they called Pops and respected. And also realized, oh, you know, he was a really good player. Now, he took it very, very seriously. You know, I say that he's not, you know, I'm sure he didn't mind if there was crying in the in baseball, because he probably did it himself in some of the seasons, I think, because he took it very seriously. He also, there's a lot of quotes where he defends the game and also highlights some of the women who are still now in either just have passed or are very old right now. A lot of those players at that time, he was willing to speak out for how good they really are.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's wonderful to see that there's a series now, you know, on Amazon.
Yeah.
Plus, or streaming from it. And the movie, of course, you know,
right,
gave it all the attention that it deserves. So.
But he said that it was not a novelty that the women really knew how to play. They amazed him. So that's pretty cool.
One of the great things about his youth, and one of the great things that I stumbled on, is he played as a teenager on a team called the Black Knights. They were called that because they were owned by a semi-pro team owned by a man named Bobby Black, and they would play. You know, they wouldn't barnstorm, but they would play exhibition games against minor league teams. They were all adults, but the only teenager, the only 16-year-old was Dave Bancroft. Well, one of the teams that they played that was touring were the Boston Bloomers. The Boston Bloomers are a forgotten, perfect for this show. Boston Bloomers in 1908 were a traveling, nearly all women's team. And they played him. He played that team in 1908 as a 16 and 17-year-old. He was in games against that team 4 or 5 times. So women's baseball. Now, the Boston Bloomers would come into town, and if you see team photos of them, I'd say 6, 7 of the players were women, and a couple others were men who came in. But they were very much billed as a female team. Mm-hmm. And the crowds loved them. The crowds loved the Boston Bloomers. They went into his hometown and were cheering on that. And it's one of the things I love. And I tend to think nobody ever asked him to tie, you know, you played against this a team years ago of all women, and now you're coaching them, you know, did that influence you? But I have to have a gut feeling that, he certainly knew that there was talent, even as a teenager. I mean, he saw it in too many games. There were extremely close, good, competitive games against a very good semi-pro team he was in against women. And then later, he's in his 60s, early 60s, and he's managing the in the women's professional league. So he had respect for that from the beginning.
Very cool. All right, let's wrap it up with this. Like we said at the beginning of today's episode, and as the title of your book suggests, Beauty It Short, Dave Bancroft, the most unlikely Hall of Famer, and his wild times in baseball's first century, he's not a typical Hall of Famer and might be the most obscure, arguably the most obscure and unknown of all inductees. Why? What makes him so obscure and unknown?
That's a fantastic question. And I don't know if I can answer that, or I'm afraid that I could answer that if for another hour. How's that? You know, I was really surprised at how his hometowns, and again, where he grew up in Sioux City, Iowa, and Superior, Wisconsin, then where he lived for 60 plus years, had forgotten him. There were people that do remember that, you know, that tried to keep the name alive, but it didn't work for whatever reason. I went back to his house. And now what's significant about that house in Superior, Wisconsin, where he lived for 60 years, not a very big house, a very modest house on a pretty busy street in Superior. That was the house that the phone rang on January 31st, 1971. And he's in the middle of Sunday dinner with his wife eating chicken. He answers the phone and it's a Milwaukee reporter saying, "You're in the Baseball Hall of Fame." And he staggers and said, "That's the nicest thing I've ever heard." And he wasn't able to go to the induction. His health prevented that. He died 1 year later of heart failure. There are not many autographs of him with the plaque, the postcard plaque that you see a lot of the Hall of Famers that have on there. He did fade from view. He also was not somebody who trumpeted himself. There was an event for him after he was in the Hall of Fame that included a lot of people from Minneapolis and then in the Minnesota, Duluth and Superior areas. And he asked not to speak, although he did say a few words at the end of the event. So he was not somebody to trumpet himself at all. But at the same time, it was just magnificent. And I went to the person who, this is how obscure it was. He lived in that, in a house in Superior, Wisconsin for 60 plus years. I was there a month or two ago and a man next door was there. And I said, "Do you know who lived here decades ago? Are you aware?" And he said he had lived next door for about 10 years. And he said, you know, he gave a name of some woman. And I said, "No, no, I'm talking about way, way back." He said, "No, I have no idea." And I said it was a Baseball Hall of Famer. And he said, "You've got to be kidding." He just couldn't believe it. You know, he just did not believe it. And I told him the story, gave him a copy of the book. He said, "Oh, great, I'm a baseball fan." And then he told me the story of the house in recent years. And he said, you know, the house became then, obviously, no one was associated in the family. They hadn't lived there. The Bancrofts had not lived there. Edna died in 1984. So no one with the family was associated with the house. But over the years and in the last 10 years, it had become, as he described it, a drug house. And at that time, when I was there, standing there, I could see the graffiti was unbelievable everywhere inside the house, which is a little unusual. Fortunately, it was bought by somebody who had no idea that a Baseball Hall of Famer took a phone call in that kitchen and learned, I'm in the baseball. I'm off to Cooperstown. And it's being remodeled now. But I mean, it had to be, the interior was stripped to nothing. The point of that story is that really, you know, yeah, had he been forgotten? Absolutely. He had been forgotten by way too many people in places that he had been. And it's wonderful now to see that wrong be corrected. And it's so wonderful to hear from people as a result of the book. But it's also wonderful that the book, just like Dave Bancroft, this is a tiny publisher. We were told by some pretty good players in the book business, brace yourself, because books about obscure old-time baseball players, even Hall of Famers, are a hard sell. You're going to have trouble. And just like Dave Bancroft, The book has been a shocking success.
Yeah, you got a lot of great reviews on Amazon, a lot of 5-star reviews, and I encourage everybody to go out and get a copy of it. It really is a fun read. You have you tell some great stories in there. You really uncover the story of a terrific baseball player, a guy who was Ozzie Smith before Ozzie Smith. And I'm so glad that you connected with me and that we're getting this on Sports Forgotten Heroes. This is what this podcast is all about. And Tom, I'd like to thank you so much for spending an evening with us to tell us about Dave Bancroft.
Warren, I really enjoyed this conversation. This was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. You know, I recently visited Citizens Bank Park where the Philadelphia Phillies play. They have a Wall of Fame there. And there are 69 members of the Wall of Fame, including players, managers, executives, and owners. Amazingly, Bancroft is not one of them. He's a Hall of Famer. He was a key cog in the Phillies team that went to the World Series in 1915. That was the last World Series team the Phillies had prior to 1980. This is a gross oversight, and I hope that Tom's book and research on Bancroft help bring to light the amazing career that he had, and it sheds light into how important a member of the team Bancroft was, and that this Hall of Famer ultimately gets his plaque on that wall. He is definitely deserving of it. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Sports Forgotten Heroes, and thanks to my guest, Tom Alicia, for spending so much time with us. Pick up a copy of his book, Beauty It Short, wherever you get yours. Again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.